The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hi everyone, thanks for coming. We'll try to do our best to make for an informed and interesting discussion, but originally this panel was conceived of by Sean Jacobs, who is the founder and editor of a publication called Africa is a Country. Unfortunately, Sean can't make it today, so my words now are on his behalf. So Africa is a Country started off as a blog of media criticism, basically trying to get a critique of the way in which Africa was represented in Western media going. And more than that, provide a platform for cultural and political debates from the continent and in the diaspora. Since its foundation, Africa as a country has grown to be a significant publication that academics, journalists, media folks, artists all contribute and engage with. But given the current times, and we're living in a times of global uncertainty, crisis, political and economic catastrophes, Sean felt, and others around the project felt, it was time for Africa as a Country to change its direction. Now, the left in Africa has been devastated over the last 30 years, following structural adjustment policies, civil wars, dictatorships, and most notably, perhaps, the gutting of the higher education system across the continent. If you went back to the 1970s, you would have found the University of Dar es Salaam, for instance, was perhaps one of this leading institution for Marxist thought in the world. And Africa was at the core of many of the debates, world systems theory, agrarian reform, that would define much of the Marxist literature going forward, and also debates on the left. It was also the center of many political experiments worth engaging on the left, from Tanzania on, for instance. Now, what's happened more recently is the disappearance of a visible African left from the public sphere has resulted in a cultural turn, if you would have it, in terms of representations of Africa, in which journalists from Vice go on these safaris to Johannesburg or Nairobi or Lagos to find, hey, there's, you know, some cool hipster-looking Africans, and this is what, like, political change will look like in Africa by the sort of Afropolitan middle class. Now, given that we believe firmly in a socialist project in the African continent, we thought it was time to, instead of, in terms of the left academic work produced on Africa, in the sense it's always from somewhere else, someone right, even though we are all based in Western institutions, but it is based on a dialogue to other Western scholars. Now, Africa as a Country is being re-envisioned as a project which is meant to be a dialogue for the African left, a dialogue focused more specifically on producing a cultural, political, and economic analysis of the current situation in Africa and building a new discussion that brings together people, that provides an orientation for those people who feel maybe isolated in the difficult political circumstances which can be found across the continent, from a recognizable left project and a place where people can engage and build a dialogue, a critique, a new vision of a pan-African dialogue going forward. So Jacobin Magazine and Africa as a Country have partnered together in order to relaunch this publication as a place of dialogue for the left in Africa. I think it's a very exciting and worthwhile project. I think that given the fact that so often Africa has been portrayed, even by people supposing the left is a place where left politics doesn't happen, and the representations of Africa are reduced to essentially a place where post-politics subsistence take the place of what should be an informed and engaged critique. This is the vision that we brought this panel together. All of us have contributed to Africa as a Country, and we have all the work today focuses on the post sort of to around 2011, when the effects of the sort of global recession really began to hit Africa, on re-envisioning the political history of this point, and where is the politics of the continent at this moment? And we have a really great panel together today, and I'm really excited to hear what people have to say. And without any more words from myself, I had to improvise because Sean didn't appear, but Zach will get started.
Sure. Well, thank you all for coming out today. Thank you for the introduction. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a book that I published in 2015 with a co-author named Adam Branch called Africa Uprising, Popular Protest and Political Change. And what it tries to do is to provide a history of African protests, really try to derive if there are any specific characteristics of African protests that we can discern in order to understand what we term as the third wave of African protests, which is really a series of protests that began in 2005 and seem to be continuing into the contemporary moment. Let me just say that when we sort of first conceptualized this book, Adam was at the time teaching at the Makerere Institute for Social Research in Kampala, Uganda, and I was based at the University of Dar es Salaam as a Fulbright visiting professor there. And so much of what we were doing was informed by a sense that there were all these massive uprisings unfolding in the region, even in our immediate context. Adam was actually in Uganda during the 2012 Walk to Work protest, but by and large, the sort of global left had ignored or excluded what we considered to be a major upsurge of popular protest from any sort of consideration about popular uprisings generally, right? And so we really set out to write this book as a corrective to what we perceived as a sort of generalized exclusion of African protests from broader conversations about global protests, right? So we had these two kind of demands, on one side wanting to see if we could come up with a way to think about and talk about African protests that doesn't just sort of flatten it into a generalized form of resistance, but also to put it into conversation with uprisings that were taking place elsewhere. Okay, so let me start by just sort of providing a bit of an overview of what we learned by looking back historically at these earlier waves of protests. And we start really in the 1940s and 50s with the range of anti-colonial protests led by specifically African movements seeking to overthrow colonial rule across the continent. Most of you are, I'm sure, familiar with this history. It's probably the last time that African protests really generates any sort of interest in the West in particular. Perhaps the most central figure during this period, of course, is Kwame Nkrumah, the leader of the Convention People's Party in the Gold Coast. And what we do in the book is try to focus on, in particular, on a set of debates that, you know, he had sort of implicitly and explicitly with Frantz Fanon, the great Martinican thinker, around two issues in particular. The first, of course, I think as most of you know, is the question of violent versus nonviolent strategies of resistance. This is obviously a well-known debate. Nkrumah, influenced by Mohandas Gandhi in the National Congress, was often the sort of key theorist of nonviolent action in the context of the African continent. And Fanon is often sort of framed as a sort of the counterpoint to this, as the apostle of violence. But what I want to say, and I think this was a very important point for us, is that Fanon's interest in violence was not simply about moral questions. Right? His starting point that he sort of presented in the book was that in order to understand Fanon's perception on violence, we need to recognize that for him, it begins as a material reality that defines political action in the African context. For Fanon, violence was often used to dismiss the political agency of Africans by placing them outside of legitimate forms of political action, and that's a tendency that I would suggest continues today. But for Fanon, the recurring character of violence within African protests meant that it could not be dismissed or tamed, and should instead be the starting point for any prescriptions around African liberation. So for us, what that did is to try to tear down a distinction that is often reified in most academic and media accounts of African protests, which is once a protest devolves into violence, it is dismissed as rioting, right? Any sort of political content is removed from these actions. The second is the question of the organization of the popular front. Right? Nkrumah insisted on a clear hierarchy within any popular movements, with the political party at the apex. His strategy was to sort of leverage the threat of what, you know, historians call the detribalized natives, otherwise in Accra, specifically known as the Veranda Boys. These were essentially young men who had come into the city of Accra and who were not employed with any sort of former colonial labor sector. In the 1940s, there were a series of riots that occurred in Accra. Historically, now we refer to them as the Accra riots, and sort of Nkrumah's explicit strategy was to try to tame the passions of these so-called veranda boys and bring them into the broader political party-led movement for independence. Essentially, what he offered the British was either you deal with me through the Convention People's Party, or you'll have to deal with them. Right? So for Nkrumah, this sort of lumpen proletariat, to use kind of the terms of the time, was both a resource to be wielded against colonial authorities, as well as a threat to his own dominance within the independent movement. Right? They were always sort of positioned within the movement, but also outside of it as well. And they were never given any sort of say over the direction in which the movement eventually took. For Fanon, however, this lumpen element is the truly revolutionary class in the African context, because only they, unlike the formal working class, which is the colonial organized labor sector, or civil society elites, which you know we would include political parties, academics, non-governmental organization, this lumpen proletariat, this veranda boys, are the only truly autonomous class who are free of the sort of petty privileges that defined colonial rule. And as such, it is they who must be incorporated and not just manipulated if a revolution is to be successful. Right? For Fanon, revolution is a mechanism through which they evolve from their vagrant status into potentially the vanguard of a movement. Let me quote from the book a little bit to sort of describe how Fanon understood this interaction between individual will and collective action, which was sort of central to how he presents the role of what he terms the lumpen proletariat. Quote, Fanon describes how uprisings represent a cleansing and redeeming power for individuals as they become part of a larger collectivity. In revolutionary moments, he writes, quote, you can no longer be a fella, a pimp, or an alcoholic as before. For Fanon, rebellion, quote, invests their character with positive and creative qualities, and these, quote, new men with a new language and new humanity come together to form a new nation. A new morality emerges for, quote, they won't become reformed characters to please colonial society, fitting in with the morality of its rulers. Instead, they are, quote, rehabilitated in their own eyes and in the eyes of history. Right. So our approach in the book is to try to center these two tensions, right? Which we frame as between a formalized civil society, by which we include political parties, NGO organizations, labor groups, academics, working within the formal logic of colonial and post-colonial rule to make incremental reforms, versus what we, borrowing from the Indian theorist Partha Chatterjee, term political society. Right? In essence, you know, lacking a better term than lumpen proletariat, we take Chatterjee's understanding of political society and accept the characterization that essentially what they are calling for is a more radical, potentially violent solutions, and whom we contend have always been at the forefront of African protest, even as their contributions have been overlooked. If you look back historically at this sort of first wave of anti-colonial protests, it was certainly successful by kind of conventional metrics of how we judge popular movements. It helped trigger the wave of decolonization that characterized much of the 1960s and spread into the 1970s. But as Fanon warned, you know, empowering political parties over popular energies only served to reinforce the autocratic tendencies that many post-independence leaders had absorbed from colonial systems of rule. And so if you look at the kind of post-independence history of Ghana, in many ways, Fanon's premonitions largely came true as Fanon became as Nkrumah becomes increasingly autocratic and shuts down any sort of spaces for dissent in the newly named Ghanaian context. That brings us to the second wave of African protest, which really were the anti-structural adjustment protests of the late 80s and 1990s. This wave we sort of trace to a series of protests that began in Sudan in 1985 and then eventually spread westward, culminating in 1990 with 14 mass uprisings in the West African context. Again, if you look at the sort of composition of who actually took to the streets, it was what we call political society that was at the forefront, who often participated in these very often violent protests against these entrenched autocratic regimes. Yet the denouement was similar to the earlier wave. While these protests were successful in triggering a formal process of democratization, it did little to address the concerns of the broader masses who actually took to the streets. Initially, this wasn't sort of foreordained. There was a very interesting process in some countries referred to as the Sovereign National Conferences, which initially sought to bring together elements from across rural and urban Africa in order to write new constitutions based on popular aspirations. But very quickly, this Sovereign National Conference process was co-opted by opposition elites who reduced these sort of broad calls for fundamental political and economic change into more narrow calls for multi-partyism and elections. Right? Again, you know, I don't want to dismiss this. It certainly led to a substantive political transformation in the continent. Africa, for example, went from only having about three democracies of any sort into the 1990s, and then in a very, very quick, almost 15-year period, to over 30 countries which were classified as somewhat democratic, and I think 40 countries which held elections in some form. Right? But again, the question is, you know, what does, in the first wave, a formal process of decolonization, and the second wave is a formal process of democratization, do to actually meet the demands of the vast majority of people who are actually taking to the streets? And by and large, as we suggest, it did little. Right? And that brings us to the third wave, which is really the focus of the book, and which we sort of suggest begins in 2005 in Ethiopia. We actually have data on this, and you can see how it crests in 2011 with mass uprisings in over 20 African countries, including four North African states. This is a point that we can talk about, the tendency to exclude these four North African countries from a broader conversation about African protests. What we show in the book is that if you look at this historically, rather than 2011 being sort of the initiation of a wave of protests, it actually represents the crest. And in 2011 alone, as I said, over 20 African countries had mass uprisings. If we look at this over the past 10 years, from 2005 to 2015, we document in the book over 40 African countries that have had such mass uprising, including ongoing uprisings in Ethiopia, Cameroon, DRC, Zimbabwe, there are others. But those are some that received the most attention. Many of these protests are framed as essentially middle class or civil society protests. This feeds very much into a narrative of Africa rising, which has captured the Western imagination over the past decade. It's not simply limited to Africa. The same tendency is used to characterize protests across Asia or Latin America. It's the revolt of the middle classes. But again, if you look at the sort of composition of who actually takes to the streets, the vast majority of participants in this latest wave of popular protests across Africa has been drawn from political society, what we would consider the urban underclass. And our strategy for the book, in addition to providing this history, is to try to look inside four specific African uprisings of the past 10 years. Specifically, we look at the 2005 protests in Ethiopia, and then later protests in Uganda, which were known as the Walk to Work protests. Some of you may be familiar with these. A series of protests that began in 2013 in Sudan, particularly in Khartoum and the surrounding areas. And the 2012 Occupy Nigeria protests, which of course were held in Nigeria, and which were, I think, to the surprise of most people, the largest Occupy protests in the world by far. Occupy Nigeria protests brought millions of people out in the streets in numbers that blew away similar Occupy protests elsewhere, yet received almost no coverage in the Western media, and again, I would say, in the Western left media as well. So it's pretty striking that, you know, you have these moments where you can see clear points of connection, but consistently Africans are left out of the conversation. What we're particularly interested in all of these protests is the interplay between what we term civil society and political society actors. Our conclusions is that the protests are defined by these contingent processes that occur in the midst of popular uprisings. Thus, rather than sort of focusing on specific outcomes of the protests, so one of the reasons the protests are often dismissed is they don't achieve any sort of specific outcome. They often fail to even define a specific agenda for what they are protesting for, and so that becomes a basis to ignore their contributions. And what we want to suggest is that, you know, the specific outcomes matter little. What matters more are the internal dynamics, and specifically how they create and constrain opportunities for political action, rather than simply deciding whether they are successful or not. Right? By that standard, of course, most of them would have failed. Yet they are still meaningful politically. And so this is what we try to focus on in the book, specifically trying to understand the ways in which participation in political protests, the sort of tense set of interactions between formalized civil society actors and this broader thing that we call political society, leads to the production of new political visions for reform and transformation. Right? Across our cases, we see even where protests peter out, often like one of the consistent dynamics we see is the sort of tensions between civil society and political society bubbling over to actually lead to a break between the two. Right? So in the Occupy Nigeria protests, at first you have, you know, this massive swell of protest spreading from Lagos to throughout the country, millions take to the streets. You have this neat synthesis of labor groups who are providing the backbone to the protests, NGOs which provide kind of the rhetoric of the protests, and then ordinary people who provide the bulk of the protests. But in essence, what occurs in the context of these sort of fraught social forces engaging in this protest is that the labor groups start opening a backdoor negotiation with the government, receive direct concessions from the Nigerian state, and hence withdraw their support for the protest movement as a whole, which then promptly collapses, lacking that sort of infrastructure to sustain its mass character. I don't want to sort of just blame this on labor. I think one of the things we see consistently is that these are explicit counter-protest strategies devised by the state to try to capitalize on these existing divisions within the movement. I also don't want to romanticize, you know, the role of political society in this. I mean, obviously, when we're talking about such an amorphous category of different populations, and one of the things that we've been criticized for the book, which I really appreciate, is that we sort of undersell the darker directions in which sometimes political society energies can be turned. Right? And so we see this in many of the different protests, where initially these sort of broad demands for a fundamental political and economic change are instead co-opted and turned into instruments of xenophobia or the identity-based forms of exclusion. Right? So one of the things that's interesting is to look at, for example, the protests in South Africa and sort of try to connect those to the outbreaks of xenophobic violence that seem to draw in very much the same category of social actor that we are interested in. How much time do I have?
I've still got like 4 minutes.
Okay, perfect. All right, so a few more things I'll just say here and then I'll wrap up. So what's driving the protests? I mean, I think, you know, it's difficult sort of deploying the language of a wave to speak about any sequence of events, particularly in countries that are independent and distinct from each other. But we were sort of fairly convinced that this is a wave of protest, that this that African countries share certain specific characteristics that help explain why we're seeing such an upsurge in protests across the continent right now. I'll just mention two, one economic, one political, that I think are very central to our analysis. The first is sort of the nature in which African countries continue to be incorporated into the global economy. If you look at sort of the literature around the rise of Asia, one of the things that we see economists talking a lot about is that, you know, on one very basic level, African countries have benefited tremendously in terms of growth levels by Asian foreign direct investment. You can see this across the board. I think that more than 80% of African countries have had growth rates of 3% or higher for the past decade, which is certainly an extraordinary phenomenon. But the nature of a commodity-driven investment boom has produced some perverse outcomes in terms of African labor markets. So if you actually look at what the outcome has been of all this foreign direct investment, so if you look at it from the perspective of sort of the international financial institutions, the great purpose of always recommending that African countries, that countries in general, make their economies more favorable to foreign direct investment is that foreign direct investment should trigger a process of industrialization. Right? And as you have kind of the creation of an industrial sector, you create more formalized jobs that then bring in ordinary people who benefit from the growth overall. Right? That's the classical model. That is not what has happened in the African context. This is not my conclusion. This is something the World Bank itself has acknowledged. If you look at sort of the World Bank literature on, for example, Nigeria, there's a very interesting quote where they say, Nigeria represents a puzzling case of relatively high levels of growth, but no absolute reduction in poverty. And this is not surprising if you actually look at how investment has come into the continent. Almost all of it is targeted towards the rural areas, towards natural resource expropriation. What this does is actually create a huge influx of migrants from the rural areas into the urban areas. This is often the people who then constitute what we call political society. And by and large, they are not being absorbed in anything like a formal labor sector because, of course, there is no growth of industrialization in African countries as a result of this foreign direct investment. Mm-hmm. Instead, what happens is they get incorporated into the informal or the illicit sectors and hence constitute exactly what we are talking about when we speak of political society. And again, these are not our opinions. These are sort of noted things that economists themselves have pointed out. Africa, in economic terms, has been going through a period of deindustrialization. Again, a very strange phenomenon that accompanies relatively robust growth rates. For example, currently Africa is actually less industrial than it was in the 1980s, which is a fairly striking outcome, particularly considering that the 1980s represents sort of a protracted period of economic decline across the continent. Okay? So that's the sort of big economic story that we think is going on here. Politically, I think it's, you know, it's a story that we're probably fairly familiar with. If you look at sort of trends in democratization, and we can leave aside what we mean by democratization for now, but at least according to sort of formal indices of democratization, Africa went through a prolonged period of democratization from really sort of the 80s through the 2000s. That has largely come to a halt, and increasingly we see democratic backsliding, to use the term. But it's interesting in that most of the regimes that have started to abandon formerly democratic practices are not making outright power grabs. Instead, what they do is they find ways to create authoritarian systems that can live alongside or coexist very comfortably with certain types of formal democratic practices. So almost all of the authoritarian regimes in Africa, for example, will hold regular elections, will have a parliament, will have relatively free medias, will have a somewhat independent judicial sector. Yet, fundamentally, power doesn't tend to be distributed very broadly, right? What this does, I think, for us, in terms of how we understand this, is that by and large, there isn't a sense that people who are taking to the streets in many of these protests are worthy of sympathy, right? So if you look at kind of how the West and the international community more broadly generates empathy for popular movements elsewhere, it's usually the perception of the autocrat in power, right? So when you talk about like a Hosni Mubarak or somebody else who's perceived as being beyond the pale, that tends to generate a lot of outrage and perhaps solidarity with different types of movements. When you instead are talking about someone like Yoweri Museveni in Uganda, who has been the dictator of the country for over 30 years, yet somebody who is, you know, a close ally of the United States, somebody who has been historically favorable, who historically gets along well with non-governmental organizations, gets along well with international financial institutions, who holds regular elections, has a relatively free press, has a parliament that does things, people don't perceive it as being as bad as other places. And hence, there isn't much of an interest in trying to engage with these different movements that have emerged in places like Uganda. All right. Okay, so last thing I'll say. So coming back to the sort of where I think Ben sort of started us is this question of what we do as a global left or a would-be global left. I think, you know, it's undoubtable and, yeah, that Africa has been left out of most conversations of popular movements. We actually read a whole bunch of literature that came out a few years ago on popular uprisings globally. It's very interesting how even, you know, left thinkers from places you wouldn't expect completely exclude Africa from their analysis. So they'll jump from protests in South America to North America to Western Europe to parts of Asia, and they'll say maybe one day it'll come to Africa too. And it's a pretty striking thing. I mean, I think especially in the context of the Arab Spring, there was all these pieces that came out and said, when will the Arab Spring move south? And we kept on trying to say, like, well, actually, you know, the better question to ask is how did the Arab Spring move north? And that, you know, is a point that I think many African movements understand intimately, but the left has particularly ignored. So I'll just say that, you know, I think all of us need to pay a lot more attention to what African movements are doing, because in many ways they have been at the forefront of challenging sort of creeping authoritarianism that is becoming more and more familiar to us in Western societies, particularly in the neoliberal context, right, where you have these authoritarian regimes that don't seem so bad as authoritarians of past generations, but in many ways are going to require theorizing that understands their particular strengths and perhaps their particular weaknesses as well. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
That was a fantastic introduction to this course. And I hope that, but this also sets the stage for moving further on the panel, because we've got the broader historical perspective of where Africa has been for the last few years in the global conjecture. Now we're going to move to the regional level of North Africa, and I think it's important to pay attention to North Africa because the way, as Zach mentioned earlier, that the Arab Spring was represented, it was something that wasn't happening in Africa, it was happening in the Middle East. It was the Arab Spring, but this is part of the continent and has deep links to areas which are considered sub-Saharan Africa too. Mm-hmm. And with that in mind, we turn to Yusuf. Yusuf is a I should have actually introduced everyone at the beginning, but let me just do that quickly. Zach is a associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Vassar College. Yusuf is a graduate of the New School University graduate program in international affairs. Samira is a PhD candidate in history at Yale University.
Anthropology, actually. Because I know his mistake.
Yeah, this is Sean's mistake. All mistakes go before the absent chair. And I am a PhD student in Latin American history at NYU, but I'm also South African. But so, okay, so let's turn to Yusuf now.
Great, thanks. So if we're going to talk about revolution in Northern Africa, we're going to be talking about two basic things. We're going to be talking about the effects of neoliberalism and Islamism as a political project, which has obviously come to the fore since 2011 and sort of subsumed a lot of the initial interest that the left had in what was going on in North Africa. And if we're going to discuss neoliberalism, as you mentioned at the top, neoliberalism is obviously in a crisis right now. 2016 obviously delivered the sort of twin political shocks of the Brexit vote in the UK and Hillary Clinton's defeat at the hands of Donald Trump, which we could both read as sort of repudiations of neoliberal ideological dominance in the West. The French election today, we could be on the verge of a third significant political repudiation of neoliberalism at the very center of this sort of economic and political system that was built in the image of neoliberalism in the past 30 years. But the fallout from that crisis, which goes back to 2007, as you mentioned, the first significant political fallout from that crisis took place in North Africa with the fall of the Tunisian regime and spread to Egypt and the rest of the Arab world, obviously coming up from Africa, as you mentioned as well, from sub-Saharan. But these developments are all part of a wider process, I think, which some on the left, and I think we can read with some confidence as sort of the neoliberal era perhaps coming to some kind of conclusion or entering a crisis that could be signifying its end. It was an era defined by, obviously, a neoliberal ideology becoming hegemonic globally, especially in the West, but globally, really. And this was supported by American geopolitical dominance since the decline of the Cold War. In 2011, when the Arab Spring started, the demands of the mass of people were made sort of explicitly in terms of those two characteristics of the world system. So dismantling economic structures created under the auspices of neoliberalism and dismantling the political structures that supported American dominance in the Arab region. They were demanding elections, justice, employment, an end to austerity. And it was hoped on the left that through achieving limited liberal democracy, that we could move forward and sort of achieve a deeper democratic reorganization of power in the Arab world. But it's obviously been 6 years since the Arab Spring started. And through all the tumult, there has not been much progress on those fronts. In fact, in some places, obviously, things have gotten worse. The sort of fiery articulation of 2011 was subsumed by this old ideological binary that has been dominant in the region for the past 30 or 40 years. The old style secular authoritarianism of the aging Arab nationalist regimes and its Islamist critique. And these are the two ideological tendencies that became even more powerful. Rather than destroying the old sort of ideological environment, these two poles reinforced each other and became more powerful in the wake of the 2011 uprising. Obviously, I don't need to go into detail about what happened in Syria and Libya, but even in places where civil war was averted, like Egypt, these two poles are still dominant. In Egypt, the old regime is back, it's more authoritarian than ever, and it's pursuing deeper austerity than it has before. It's closer to Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in terms of its regional alignment than it was before, even under Mubarak. In Tunisia, liberal democracy is still intact, but the governing coalition is one between precisely those two elements, a reconstituted old regime party and an Islamist party. And they've also, both countries have signed fresh IMF agreements in the past year to continue to pursue austerity in exchange for credit, et cetera. So revolution in North Africa would obviously, as we all know, be a revolution against the economic consequences of neoliberalism, but it also must be a revolution against these two ideological poles that have become stronger in the wake of the revolution. So my argument is that the sort of social and economic problems caused by neoliberalism in practice are obviously a consequence of neoliberalism operating as an ideology, but these same problems and processes facilitated the rise of Islamism as a popular force in the Arab world in the past three decades. So if we're going to discuss neoliberalism as sort of more than structural adjustment, more than draconian economic austerity, we're discussing an ideology that systematically circumscribes political possibilities by positing its own conception of the roles of the market and the state as not only superior to other conceptions, but also as apolitical, as objective, as beyond contestation. Neoliberals posit that there is no alternative to the marketization that they argue is best. And this has sort of been, neoliberalism rose to ideological hegemony in the late 70s, early 80s, as the economic structures of the post-World War II order started collapsing. We had the collapse of Bretton Woods, the OPEC oil strike, which facilitated the third world debt crisis, and the proliferation of structural adjustment programs using the force of international finance. In the West, the welfare state was open to critique, deindustrialization happened, but in the third world, industrialization as a way to transcend the condition that birthed the third world was sort of declined as an idea. The gains of the state-led era, the gains of the modern era, were shown to be vulnerable and reversible, and they were reversed through structural adjustment. Politically, the Soviet Union began its decline, obviously. Socialism became less of a tenable political project. Capitalism was the only game in town in terms of achieving development. And this, to get these two sort of processes, eroded politics. Economic questions were removed from the arena of political contestation, both physically and literally through the imposition of structural adjustment programs on indebted countries, but also ideologically, as the economic questions were left increasingly to technical expertise. This sort of led to a disillusionment with the ideals of modernity, with its teleological belief in progress through reason. In intellectual circles, we had the decline of the grand narrative, which obviously Marx articulated the grandest narrative of them all. Even in aspiration, the idea of objectively understanding society became passé, rubbished by intellectuals, most vehemently by those that would become the postmodern left, as the left in general jettisoned the class analysis, which they understood now as another grand narrative worthy of critique. The emphasis shifted onto subjectivity, onto discourse, and we had the rise of identity politics in the West. And there is a sort of Arab corollary to this disillusionment with modernity that started in 1967. Obviously, we had the Six-Day War, which is a huge blow to the discourse of Arab nationalism, which had dominated the region since the 40s, 50s, 60s. But Arab nationalism had an economic as well as a political component. In the wake of the defeat of 1967, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, initiated a rightward shift in both. By the 1980s, that Egyptian shift by the 1980s, it had sort of engulfed the entire region. The Arab state itself was shifting from the social state to the regulatory state under the auspices of neoliberalism. So the 70s was a decade of austerity as well as the 80s. We had food riots in Egypt in 1977, Morocco in 1981, Tunisia in 83, Jordan in 89. In Algeria, basically a decade of austerity led to the civil war, which started in the 90s. Throughout the 80s, Arab countries signed IMF structural adjustment deals. Sudan in 79, Morocco in 83, Tunisia and Egypt both in 87, Jordan in 89, and in the early 90s, Algeria, Yemen, and Lebanon followed suit. This sort of came together in an ideological crisis in the Arab world. The social contract built under the auspices of Arab nationalism was disintegrating. In terms of politically, the ideology declined because the ideals of Arab unity and anti-imperialism, which these regimes used to legitimate themselves, were jettisoned. They turned inward to deal with the fallout of the economic crisis of the 70s and 80s. Economic and social modernization, the very ideals that these regimes used to legitimate themselves, sort of were undone through the process of neoliberal restructuring in the 80s and 90s. And this was fertile ground, of course, for the articulation of the Islamist discourse, which posited the crisis that the Arab world was going through in the 70s and 80s as a failure of a particular conception of modernity, which they argued was Eurocentric. So they were arguing that the discourse of the Arab nationalists was Eurocentrist, and that those regimes were imposing this conception of modernity at the expense of a supposedly authentic Islamic identity and culture. This served as a powerful critique of the status quo in the Arab world in the 70s and 80s, and the sort of ailing nationalist regimes had no ideological response to this critique. They were stripped of their legitimating tenets, as I said, industrialization, economic modernization, et cetera. These ideas became less tenable. Socialism itself, obviously, Arab unity, they were sort of discredited as ideas. And of course, the regional and international environment facilitated a rightward shift in the Arab states. The conservative Gulf monarchies were newly rich with petroleum money from the windfall in the wake of the 1973 strike. And of course, the US was looking to secure a favorable order in the region, so it was happy to continue aiding these regimes as they became increasingly authoritarian and less popularly legitimate. So over time, the regimes were sort of reduced in terms of their discourse to a negation only of Islamism. And this is the binary that has dominated since the 70s in the Arab world. In 2011, of course, the sort of systems that kept this situation going collapsed. Decades of dropping trade barriers, lowering wages, privatizing industries led to rising inequality. The governments had systematically stripped their populations, of course, of protections from fluctuations in the international markets, and their political structures collapsed. And Islamists were able to capitalize. So I think if we're going to discuss what revolution in North Africa looks like, it would obviously not be through Islamism. In the Islamist brief time in power, when they did achieve power in Egypt and Tunisia, they demonstrated not only their willingness to make deals with the old regime, but the hollowness of their program and the inability of their program to deal with the major causes of the revolution in the first place. But the way forward also is not a return to the authoritarian stability represented by the old regime. The same discourse that the old regime uses is the discourse of the neoconservatives in the region, that it's either authoritarian secularism or Islamism. And that model has obviously proven over decades that it has nothing to offer. The logical extension of that discourse, obviously, is what's going on in Syria, where it's sort of a war to annihilate the Islamists. But of course, so in Tunisia and Egypt, the mainstream left has also demonstrated that it buys into this discourse sometimes and devolves into nothing but a negation of the Islamist project rather than articulating its own alternative to both the old regime and the Islamists. The way forward is obviously not liberalism as well, because its fragility was demonstrated in Egypt, where the liberal democratic regime was overthrown by the government, the generals. In Tunisia, where the liberal democracy still exists, it has been unable to address the core causes of the revolution, the economic causes of the revolution. As I said in the beginning, Tunisia has just signed an IMF Structural Adjustment Program agreement earlier this year. So what is the way forward? I think that it would be a fundamental reorganization of power that can only be achieved through an extension of democracy beyond the limits of.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.